Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Let me tell you what we've got planned for today. I have been accumulating a bunch of my little thoughts, my best thoughts about career, work, and the micro perspective, practical stuff for you, but also big picture, what's important for the world in the world of work. We're going to start with a bunch of those. I've just been accumulating too many of them, and you'll view it as like a potpourri, a buffet, hopefully of a bunch of interesting ideas. Hopefully at least one will be of interest to you. Then I'm going to go to something a little more focused, because these are going to go from one thing to another. But then I have, in recent years, I'm obsessed with what it really takes to make people change. And by nature, I tend to be complex. I wrote a 774-page book. I've written a bunch, I think long form. But when I really look back at all my clients and I look at humanity and what makes humanity change, it's remarkable that very often it is embarrassingly simple. Things like bumper stickers, phrases like do random act of kindness or save the earth have probably done as much to move humankind as all the fat tomes. I may be wrong. So I thought about how can I translate it into something of value to you, my dear listeners, and that is how to help you develop your own personal slogan that might help you with your work life and out. So we're going to do that. But most of the show will be devoted to you. So I'm not going to give out the phone number now, but 10, 15, 20 minutes from now, I will give out the phone number and invite you to call in for what I call a workover. It does not require any pummeling, but I will try to help you with whatever work-related problem you or someone you love has. So that is my agenda. I hope you'll stay with us for the whole hour if you can. And if not, I welcome you. You're giving me part of your Sunday. Okay, first, these kind of fairly random work-related thoughts that I have had that I wanted to share with you. Number one. It seems that in earlier times, certainly in earlier centuries, half the people with an IQ under 100 could make a decent living. They were in agriculture or they were in manufacturing. But ag has become so automated. I mean, it was mentioned in the previous show on philosophy talk about factory farms. How many jobs have been lost because so much of farming is automated? A lot of those people who did have IQs under 100, and half the population by definition has an IQ under 100, can't make a living in agriculture. How much manufacturing has been automated or offshored? Probably the single thing I worry most about that I do not have a solution for is what is going to happen to the half of the population that's got an IQ under 100? Most people want to work, they want to be productive, but are there jobs that pay a living wage? Enough of those jobs? There's 338 million people in the United States. That means there's 169 million of them with an IQ under 100. 169 million. Probably at least 100 million of which are not children and are not, in retirement age. That's just amusing. I usually try, my rule on the show is don't bring up a problem you can't unless you can solve it. But this is, to me, the foundational question. When we look at the conflicts around the world, many of us believe that they're based on economics, on people's inability to make a sustainable living. And we can blame, corporate greed, we can blame the unions, we can blame all kinds of things. But we certainly have a more technologically advanced society and a more automated society, and a more global society. And so what does that mean for the half of the population that doesn't listen to KELW, public radio, or read The New Yorker? These are the other, the invisible other that we don't see. What's going to happen to them? It seems like a very sad world if we're simply going to, give them handouts. That's disempowering. Just because they have an IQ under 100 doesn't mean they can't accomplish anything. And if we give them too much, then does that not induce torpor? I don't know. We also want to be humane, certainly. You know, how do you judge, you know, how much effort do we require of people when there are few jobs out there? Somebody's got an IQ of 85 or 90, and they're, you know, they'll say they don't try that hard because they know it's very hard to find a decent job. So they're going to work their guts off to land a job at $10 an hour in a warehouse if they can get it. And we can deny them welfare because or unemployment because they didn't work hard enough to get it. But on the other hand, if they do nothing and they sit around there, do we feel good about giving them? You know, it's complicated and hard. So that's one musing I have. Completely, as I said, these are completely different. This is about students. I have a number of clients who are new college graduates or new graduate school graduates. Maybe the key for a student or a recent graduate to land a good job, because we hear that over half, about half of all college graduates under 25 are doing jobs they could have gotten out of high school or unemployed. It seems to me the single most important tip is to build a relationship with a well-connected professor who really likes you, or you could get to really like you. Visit their office hours. Importantly, ask to be their assistant. Ask for their mentorship. And those professors may be your bridge to a decent job, unless you have great family connections or whatever. So that was another musing. And another of the things that have popped into my brain that I wanted to share with you is so many people, everybody thinks they're a clear communicator, and huge numbers of people are not. If you sense that a lot of times people aren't quite getting what you're saying, this is a useful, I've found, my clients have found it to be a useful tip. Pretend that you're talking to a bright 12-year-old and be concise, be crisp. Say whatever you're going to say in 30 seconds or less. You'll leave out a lot of details, but it's a lot easier to be concise and logically rigorous and clear in 30 seconds or less than it is in 3 minutes. So pretend you're talking to a bright 12-year-old and be crisp, saying it in 30 seconds or less. Next point. I really think that, you know, unfortunately, it makes me puke to tell you the truth. You know, with this gross oversupply of job applicants, unless you're a star, you know, you went to Stanford and you majored in computer sciences and all of that, and you're good looking and you're personable and all the rest of it, unless you have it all, it really is about getting someone to kind of fall in love with you professionally, that is, to say, all right, this person may not be the best and brightest, but I really like them, so blah, blah, blah. Well, then, therefore, a critical skill for all but stars is being a good conversationalist. And so many people have trouble starting a conversation, whether it be in a business networking situation or in a more personal networking situation, because personal networking can often lead to business or nonprofit, you know, career-related networking. So these are two great questions to start. Hey, what's doing in your life? Or what have you been thinking about these days? Those kind of questions, you know, people generally love to talk about themselves. It's an exception. But starting that way, and then after you've asked an open-ended question like what you've been thinking about these days, then really listen hard. And then either look for an opportunity to share something about yourself, some ideally some commonality, because that builds bridges rather than, you know, saying, well, I'm very different, blah, blah, blah. People love kindred spirits. We say we celebrate diversity. That's an out-and-out lie. We generally like people who are like us intellectually in terms of our values. We may want to celebrate diversity. It may be important to celebrate diversity. But in reality, in humankind, in networking, what seems to work best is finding common ground. Next idea. Similarly in that, this is actually kind of different. Everybody wants to feel special. That helps them in choosing a career. It helps them simply as they walk through life. Now, just take a moment to think about what's special about you. What is really different about you? Should you do more with that? Right? I get a client just yesterday. This person decided he was going to learn Arabic in high school. He then joined the military. He left the military, and now he wants to go to engineering school. That is a very unusual combination. So thinking about, I mean, that's quite special. That makes him different. So his career choice might well be to work either for the government, the military, or a company, a, you know, government contract, look like a Bechtel or whatever, combining, because very often companies and the military build things in Arab-speaking countries. Unfortunately, no doubt, we, after this short-term airstrikes and whatever in Iraq, we will be asked to do some more nation building, and it will be the Bechtels of the world and the Halliburtons of the world that are going to go in there and, with our tax dollars, rebuild Iraq and whatever collateral countries get involved, you know. So think about yourself. What makes you special? And should you do more of that? The show focuses on career, so yeah, career-wise, but also personally. Completely different topic. Again, these are just my general musings. I'm going to let you know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am sharing the collection of work-related musings that I've been accumulating for you over the last couple of months. And then after that, we are going to we're going to do a little interactive exercise to help you develop a personal professional slogan that will help you hopefully in making more progress than all the tomes that you may have read. I don't know what to say about this one. I was reading a Cornell University study that basically, in essence, is reduced to this sentence: most dumb people are too dumb to know they're dumb. What's the implications of that? Very often you find yourself trying to change somebody because they just don't get it. You may, you know, we all have a certain amount of emotional energy, a certain amount of time. We need to be more conscious of whether the time is best spent. How many of my clients have told me how exhausted they are trying to remediate a coworker who just doesn't get it? So while I'm not saying ignore your weak coworkers, I'm not saying necessarily fire them, although most research shows that when you've got an intractable employee like that, it's best to cut your losses and replace him or her with somebody. But at least be more conscious of when a person seems to just not get it again and again. Maybe your time would be better spent elsewhere. And maybe if somebody is sighing all the time at you because they think you don't get it, is it possible that you are one of those people who the Cornell study is talking about? As I said, again, most dumb people are too dumb to know they're dumb. Just self-reflect. Another point of these musings: it is dangerous to read or listen to only current thought. Current thought is too reflective of the time's prevailing beliefs. For example, right now, if someone put a gun to my head and said, what is the overriding foundational belief that is governing intelligent, liberal, whatever, current thought, mainstream thought, it's that we need to redistribute more. In the previous show, it was to redistribute from people and their control, to redistribute control to animals. The previous guest talked about wanting to have a completely new idea of zoos, where animals had more control of the situation, or that we have a relationship with chickens, not that we have a right to put them in pens and kill them. You know, that's a redistributive argument. In previous eras, it was about merit. Let's find the best and brightest, and let's nurture them, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's dangerous to read or think about only the current zeitgeist. The wisest human being looks more broadly, more and more full dimension. That's the value of history. That's the value of futurism. It's not as locked into the zeitgeist. And that's really what makes somebody great at work in a strategic role, rather than just being confined by the boundaries of current conventional thought. They think in a broader, almost more cosmic perspective, as though there was all this information out there in the world, but it wasn't filtered by the societal filtration mechanisms, the media and the colleges. Okay. Next thought. I had a client. This was, like I said, I collected these starting about a month ago. So this was about a month ago. It was a person who was, kind of an average person. You know, not great, not brilliant, not stupid, not very warm, not very cold, in the middle. And this person asked me what kind of a sales job he should seek. And I told him, I said, the key is to avoid the hot fields. This is, again, the notion of not being confined by the zeitgeist of the era. Every one of my, I shouldn't say everyone, large percentages of my clients want to work in such a small percentage of fields. The environment, entertainment, biotech, political activism. There is a, if you are a star, you can get a decent job in those spheres. But because everybody thinks of being in those fields, if you are not, if you are average in intelligence, average in looks, average in technical skills, average, you'd be wise to at least consider, if your ethics and values allow it, unless you're heavily values driven and you have to be in the environment or in entertainment or being an actor or whatever, you'd be wiser to look at jobs that are out of favor. Nobody wants to work these days in transportation particularly, or unless you want to be an airline pilot, or in food distribution, or something like that. And yet, I have seen again and again that people are often happier in fields that are not so competitive, because in fields like the environment, I want to talk later about a woman who wanted to go in museum studies. Once you're in museum, in working for a museum in marketing or whatever, there's 10,000 people who want to be in museums, working for museums. And so they often don't treat you very well because they know you're replaceable. So the thought that I had there was, if you're not a star and your ethics or values can deal with it, think about going more to these more under the radar, less obvious, less hot fields. My next thought is about what I call the tawdry social media marketing game. I'm hating the practice on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, which basically is, I'll praise you so that you can praise me to your network. The result is that people's praise, instead of reflecting legitimate plaudits, legitimate belief that person has done something of quality, it's much more reflecting of scheming. Well, this person's got a big network, so I'm going to praise that person. That worries me. It's another dent in using merit as a criterion. Just like we decry racism if it denies a person of color their opportunity to be judged on their merit, this is another example of where merit is being subverted. The whole social media game, I'll praise you so you'll praise Media Network. Next thought. Recent study, 51% of college students admitted that they cheated in college. Now, if 51% admitted, you can bet there's a lot more than that, especially those who are cheaters are more likely to cheat on the questionnaire. So that is one of the many reasons, and I'm not going to go into this at great length because I've spent a number of shows documenting the ever-declining meaningfulness of a college diploma. It does not testify to writing skills or thinking skills. It's amazing the small amount of growth that is accruing, in part because of the cheating, but more so because, of course, universities are ever more research-centric, with undergraduate education being a weak stepsister in terms of who gets hired, how much attention is paid to it, how much money is paid to it. So that was my thought when I read that statistic. 51% admitted cheating in college. I was thinking about resumes. You know, you read clients. I have new clients come in all the time, and they show me their resume. And it seems like everybody, again, from the most outstanding to the most mediocre, everybody's resume says, I spearheaded this initiative. I drove phenomenal profits. You know, first of all, nobody's believing them. Employers are generally laughing at resumes like that. You know, I raised corporate profits 17%, my company's profits 17%. All that does is make the employer laugh at you, not believe anything you're going to say. It also seems to me this is an example of, it's almost a differentiator of class. If somebody's low income, they don't have the money to read, or maybe they don't, for whatever reason, they haven't read these resume books that tell you to use these very active verbs. So in some ways, you know, these resumes that have all this language about spearheading and driving are not so much an indicator of a person's quality, but how much were they willing to read these resume books. again, it feels like the best way to select somebody that is not biased in any way against class or more and is more appropriate to merit is to have simulations of difficult job tasks. Put those online instead of a stupid laundry list of criteria or job characteristics. Put, you know, two or three hard problems, simulations of problems that are actually going to be needed to be done on the job. Have the person complete it. Now, to avoid cheating, you say that this is a screening tool and that any people who pass the screening, then you will be invited to come in person, and then you're going to be asked to do similar problems under a proctored situation. But that, rather than resumes and cover letters and references, which are so larded with BS, would be a both fairer, more meritocratic, and less racist, sexist way, because we don't know. It's all based on clearly job-related criteria. Okay, next. Another musing I had, this one on also on higher ed. Professors are very insecure that they won't be rigorous enough. So their courses focus too much on what's hard. They'll make you read 10 books or 12 books, which makes students not want to read them, makes them read the Cliff Notes, makes them download term papers from other people. We don't weigh enough whether what we are requiring in school is the best use of student time. Really important to me. We should have this ordered hierarchy of what really would help students acquire what's really important: thinking skills, writing skills, connoisseurship skills, the ability to solve problems, the ability to work on a team, the ability to work individually without a team. Those are the things that are rigorous, not the multiple uses of the doppelganger in 17th century German literature. But somehow, in the name of rigor, these professors feel the need to pile on the arcane in both quality and quantity. Related to my earlier point about employment ads, if you are writing an employment ad, don't list the skills required nor that laundry list, but simply the key difficult work, the key difficult work that employee will be doing. And then, as I said, even better, have, instead of asking for the resume and cover letter, put a simulation of those key difficult pieces of work. You will get a much better candidate, as well as definitely avoid the EEOC, because believe me, there are more and more lawsuits for, you know, racial discrimination, gender discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination, age discrimination. There's no better way to insulate yourself than something that is so clearly job-related, and especially if it's online, then we can't see the person's race, gender, color, age, etc. Next. It really does, I do lament the fact that the desire to be right, the desire to be correct, usually trumps the desire for truth. People really, and I'm guilty of this myself, I try hard to be open-minded, but I am, you know, like everybody else. It feels very reassuring to be proven right. So I can only invite you, and invite myself, to realize that is it not more important to be really open to the fact that you're wrong. You know, I end every show saying we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. So, you know, being open to the possibility that you're not right and that truth is a more important goal may be worth thinking about. Okay, that's enough. I'm going to stop here. Do I want to stop here? Yeah, I'm going to stop here. Okay, so now I'm going to, I promised you that before I go to the phones, I wanted to help you develop your own personal slogan. I know that sounds simplistic, but really, creating a personal one-liner can be a very low-risk way to improve your work life and your personal life. I mean, when you know, I was thinking about it, as I said at the top of the show, how many people are changed by reading fat tomes versus how many people are changed by simplistic, embarrassingly simplistic slogans. I started by thinking about this in the commercial arena. Think of how many people bought a BMW because it is the ultimate driving machine. How many people chose Energizer over Duracell batteries because it keeps going and going and going? How many people flew United because it flies the friendly skies? How many people ate Wheaties, which tastes like crap? I bought it one time when I was a kid because it's the Breakfast of Champions? How many people rented from Avis because we try harder? And how many people insured with Allstate because you're in good hands with Allstate? Lest you think that I'm limiting this to commercial ventures, slogans have probably changed other of our behaviors. For example, I would bet that many more people bestowed kindnesses because of that "do random act of kindness" bumper sticker. I believe that probably many more people became environmentally conscious, not because of fat tomes, but because of slogans like "save the earth" and "go green." Now, those slogans were aimed at mass behavior change. But if we can create together, and that's what we're going to do now, a custom slogan for you, it may help you accomplish your goals inside of work and without. So let's try this. I have no idea if it's going to work or not. I just concocted this for the show, and then I'm planning on publishing it. Okay, so it's four steps. The first step is take a moment now to think about one thing that you would like to change in your life. Maybe it's in career. Maybe you want to get a better job. Maybe you want to improve some skill. Maybe you want to improve your work ethic. Maybe you'd like to start your own business, whatever. For example, I'm really quite honored. Last week, University of California, San Francisco, UCSF Medical School, just hired me to be a facilitator of their foundations of clinical practice, or the patient, whatever it is. Basically, how the psychological side of reading patients, making them feel comfortable, etc. I'm being paired with an MD, and we have a group of 6 to 8 students, and we're going to try to help them be more nuanced and sensitive on the interpersonal side of interacting with patients. Well, I have a tendency to give away, to give too many ideas, and that's disempowering. In my role as facilitator, my goal is to exercise more restraint, be more of a facilitator and less didactic. So that's my one career goal. I mention that merely to trigger it for you. Is there one thing you would like to change in your life? How about money, if it's not career, something related to money? Do you want to make more? Do you want to save more? Do you want to spend more? Some people are in a position where they've been tightwads and they need to spend more. Relationships. Do you want to meet a romantic partner? Do you want to improve an existing relationship? Or do you want to spend more time alone? Whatever. How about education? Is there something you really want to learn? Is that your personal the goal? This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to identify one thing first that you'd want to change, and then we're going to try to develop a slogan around it. Do you want to teach more? Maybe you're at a point where you're, instead of, you know, incorporating and taking and taking and taking and learning, maybe you want to share with others. How about health? The standard, do you want to lose weight? Do you want to stop or reduce your substance abuse? Have you been procrastinating seeing the dentist? Whatever, some health thing. Okay, so now, hopefully you now have one thing that you would like to change in your life. Now let's see if we can create a slogan for it. So that's step one. We've identified what you want to change. Step two, see if you can say what you're trying to change in 5 words or less. And ideally, say it in a clever way. Don't just say, like, lose 20 pounds. You might, for example, say, down 20 by 12/20. In other words, lose 20 pounds by December 20th. Or, let's say you're really wanting to develop the courage to quit your job. You might say, you know, kiss your boss goodbye. If you're trying to make money, you might do something silly and rhyming, like moolah boolah or something. Again, nothing is going to be right for everybody. I want you to develop something that's right for you. Let's say you want to meet somebody. Let's say you don't want to be that clever. You might want to, maybe you're despondent, you're not going to meet your romantic partner, your Mr. or Ms. Right Forever. But maybe you want to say, maybe your slogan is going to be, my true love's out there. Or let's say you're a procrastinator. You might want to say, instead of get smart, get start. Or maybe you want to do get smart. Or you want to take a course in critical thinking skills. Then maybe get smart. Another lose weight example. Maybe you used to be a size 12 and you got fatter. And you might want to say, you know, again, here's this rhyme thing. Size 12, once again. Whatever it is, try to say your goal in 5 words or less. The fewer, the better, because that's going to be more easy to remember. And then put your slogan all around. This is now step 3. So we've said your goal in 5 words or less. Step three, put your slogan all around. Like maybe you want to use it as your computer's wallpaper. Maybe you want to put it on your refrigerator. Maybe on your palm, write it on your palm. Even you could create a bumper sticker. There are websites like buildasign.com, which enable you to create a bumper sticker and buy it like for a buck or two and in a quantity as little as one, so you don't have to like buy 500 bumper stickers. And put them all around. That helps you remember it. And then finally, because even if you have it around, it doesn't quite penetrate your brain as much as if you say it. So at least for the first day or week, say your slogan aloud again and again and again until, like a music earworm, you can't get it out of your head. And that then becomes top of mind, becomes part of your consciousness. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I'm always afraid of being, I don't want to be simplistic. Of course, slogans don't always work. Even the famous Nike phrase, just do it, didn't make everybody buy Nike. But it sure made us more likely to. And there's certainly no risk in trying a slogan like this. It takes little effort. We may have done it right here in a few minutes. There's no side effects. And just maybe it'll improve your work life, maybe out of work life, without having to resort to more complicated approaches like seeing a career counselor. So anyway, okay, now as promised, the rest of the show is devoted to you. So I do what I call makeovers, or career makeovers or workovers on the show. So if you or someone you love has a work-related problem, whether you're unemployed or extremely well-employed and still miserable, self-employed, work for government, nonprofit, for-profit, doesn't matter, whether you're 16 or 76, whether it's you or someone you love, if you've got a work problem, I usually can help. The phone number here for a workover, here on Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we do have a call on the line already, so let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay, so I'm 64 years old, and I want to get a part-time job in a nonprofit directed that deals with people. I really like working with people. My favorite part of the job in a stupid clerical position I had was working on the phones and connecting people to services or to the department they needed.
Okay, and what is what have you tried so far to land that job?
Right now, I'm working with Jewish Vocational Services. I just started. I wanted to ask you, actually, if you know anything about them. They seem to have a very comprehensive
program. Absolutely. They have a fabulous relationship. Just because it's the word Jewish, don't think it's limited to Jews. As you know, there are plenty of non-Jews who both work there, and as so many Jewish people are, they're serving everybody, not just Jews at all. And they have an excellent reputation. Absolutely.
Okay.
So is really the answer there, because you happen to be already in a wonderful organization, is it that, and if you're looking for more work there, is that correct?
I'm looking for a part-time position. I wouldn't call it more work, but I'm looking for a part-time position. Right now I have a low-level political position that's going to end in 2 years, and I'm going to need the money. Going to need to replace the money I'm getting from that.
Okay, so I want to understand. So are you at JVS? What are you doing? Do you have a part-time job there, or is it volunteer work?
Oh, no, I'm taking their courses.
Oh, you're great. Okay. So what I would do would be the magic word is focus. So you're already there. It's a great place. What I would do is try to see who the people are who have some power, who you like, and who you resonate with. I mean, if somebody's receiving services, you may only be having one or two people in contact with. But ask the one person you already know. Ask for what you want. Say, you know, my dream would be to work part-time at a place like JVS where it's people-centric. And how might I be able to, over the next year or two, build the relationship such that, or the skills, such that I could get that kind of job? Is there one person at JVS that you already like?
You know something? I hadn't even thought about working at JVS. Now you're making me think. I was thinking of using them, their services, to help me develop a position where I could work with people in some nonprofit, but I don't know. I just started working with them, and now I'm thinking maybe that would be a good organization for me to work for.
It's one of the most effective I've heard in all of my years. I've been a career counselor for 29 years. I have never heard a bad thing about JVS, and I've heard many positive things. But let's not put all our eggs in that basket. Before I let you go, Tell me a little bit, you know, some people's nonprofit, you say nonprofit, their values are, they're equally interested in all the standard nonprofit things. They care about the environment, they care about women, they care about people of color. You know, they, it's all down the line. It's basically, the, it's all this, the same list of things. Is that true for you, or is there one area of nonprofit work that particularly sings to you?
Well, I couldn't say that it's an area of nonprofit work, but I can tell you that where I get the most satisfaction is when I'm connecting with another human being and helping them find something they need.
But that's not screening. That's great. I love that. So that's being kind of a connector, a bridge builder. But that doesn't help you narrow down.
I know.
And so we need to. So I'll ask the standard question in this regard. If I gave you $1 million and you had to give it away to one or two or three nonprofits, what would they? What would those one, two, or three be?
Wow. One would be micro lending.
Okay.
Another would be probably housing, helping people support housing for low-income people. And another would be probably helping people get health care, the gap between what their insurance offers and what they're able to get.
Great.
You know?
Well, there are all kinds of, there's like places that list nonprofits, and this is one for volunteers, but it also would be a place that also have some paid people. It's called volunteermatch.com. It's focused on the Bay Area. There's also catalyst.org. There's also, if you simply, for example, Kiva, I just think about microlending. Kiva, based in San Francisco, is a major entity, a nonprofit that does microlending. Clearly, for housing, Habitat for Humanity jumps to mind. There are endless healthcare nonprofits. So why don't you start by Googling, you know, Bay Area micro lending organizations or San Francisco micro lending organizations, Bay Area housing advocates. I'm just giving you typical Googling terms. Healthcare justice, single payer healthcare, you know, those kinds of terms, and use the word San Francisco or Bay Area. And that will get you other possible places to write to, talk to, build relationships with, along with JVS, so that by the time your current political activist job winds down in 2 years, you've got something. How's that sound?
It sounds like a good idea. Right now, I'm volunteering at Ashby Village. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're a network of nonprofits all over the country who help seniors to age in place.
Great. It's always easier to make progress when you're already in an organization. So
yeah.
Just as I'm encouraging you to see if you can build connections and get information from JVS, you might want to deal with the Ashby organization as well, because especially if they are an umbrella organization, they know which organizations may have gotten an infusion of funding. They may know, you know, what's going to, where you as a person, given your personality, is more likely to fit. Use your existing place to organically build out from where you are. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay. I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Okay. So if you are stuck in any way, unemployed, self-employed, I'd like to do just what I did with that previous caller, help her get a practical plan for achieving her or his goals. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm looking at a text request here. It says, I know a student who has graduated from high school. He's planning to go to a 2-year community college, then to a 4-year college. He's very interested, that is fixated, this person writes, on video games. Perhaps he wants to go into the video game industry and create video games. Does he need a college degree? What is the best career path to the video game industry? Now, there's a good example of a very, very hot career that people tend to, it tends to be extremely competitive. But it is not a field where a degree, these days, because we send such a high percentage of students to college, very many employers, because they don't want to appear racist or sexist, they do, by requiring a degree, nobody could claim it's racist to, you know, in requiring a degree. So they tend to require a degree, but it's not essential. I do know, and we actually on this show a couple of years ago, I had a couple of very successful computer game people who had dropped out of college and they did just fine. But they're the exception. If this person, given what this person just wrote to me, the implication is that this person may not be that committed to the college thing. They're very, quote, fixated on video games. The key in the end is your portfolio. So talk is cheap. A general computer science degree may help. But really, what would be helpful is if you want to be a video game designer is to design some games. They can be simple games. The employer will recognize that you do not have the resources to create, you know, some commercial level game. But creating some little simple games that show your ability to design games, that is, to create, you know, one of the basic principles of game design is make it easy to learn and hard to master, right? So showing you can do that, as well as incorporate many other principles of game design, and you have, you know, the design is not so much, you know, whether you can render, you know, they have special animators or artists who do the rendering. If this person said video game design, if he or she is a design person, it's more like creating storyline, creating levels of interest that are compelling. It's that and having a series of those that he or she would send to people who are powerful at Electronic Arts or at Activision or at all the other, you know, all the other major game makers, or even, you know, the not major game makers, because the Electronic Arts, because I'm not in that world, and that word Activision and Electronic Arts came right out the top of my head. It means it's going to be come right off the top of anybody's head who's looking for those jobs. It's the more under the radar game companies that he may have a better chance. So he certainly shouldn't limit himself to the big ones. Anyway, phone number here, Work with Marty Namco. If you or someone you love has a work problem, 415-841-4134. What is that? That's the number here at Work with Marty Namco on KALW, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. How can I help you? Hi.
Hi. Am I on?
You are.
Hi, Marty. I was just listening to your program, and when I heard career counselor, 29 years of experience, I had to pick up the phone.
Okay.
I'll shoot from the hip here. I'm 45. I've just graduated from UC Berkeley, and I don't have any, long-term work experience outside of restaurant hospitality work and a little bit of sales.
Okay.
And my question is, how do I get back into a... more or less corporate setting.
Okay.
I'm interested in something.
You're cutting out. Can you? You must be on a cell phone, I'm guessing. Can you move to a place where I can hear you? Otherwise, you'll have to call back.
Yeah, I am, Marty. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I do. I hear you fine.
Okay. In short, how does one in my circumstances get back into the workplace with people who are quite a bit younger? I could say, how can I develop experience writing-related tech world in a place where I'm doing content management? And I have to start with this.
Okay, you are cutting out, so I wish... So I'll try one more time. Let me try. I guess you must be on a VoIP. You must be on a computer on voice over IP. Is that right?
Yeah,
that's cutting in and out. Skype, I love it and I hate it. In any case, what was your major?
Rhetoric.
Okay. And rhetoric is about reasoning and critical thing. Would you say that's a real strength of yours or not really?
Yeah, also really about persuasive writing.
Persuasive writing,
and,
right.
I do a lot of writing personally. And
okay. What do you write about?
I do live storytelling. And I write autobiographical fiction, first-person essay.
Great, like okay. And so is it correct to say that you say you want to work in a corporation. Is it correct that you should be in their communications department, because that's mainly in charge of storytelling? Corporate communications, marketing, et cetera. Public relations?
Public relations, exactly.
Okay, great. Is there a particular industry that you could lay claim to having particular expertise or interest in? You know, could you equally well work for Clorox as for Williams-Sonoma, as for Apple Computer, as for a small garbage-collecting startup? Do you have any claim to expertise or interest in some niche within corporations?
Yeah, in travel. I worked as a travel writer years ago and have a lot of international travel experience. I'm also fluent in Spanish after living abroad.
Okay, great.
For 2 years.
Now, I'm jumping on the Spanish thing. Everybody loves to travel, but not everybody whose first language is English is also fluent in Spanish. And, of course, given the population demographics, that's huge. So what if I said you need to contact Spanish-serving corporations, whether it be Univision or Spanish La Tienda or whatever it is, the huge chain of Latino supermarkets. Focus on the Latino angle for starters, because I'm looking for where your unique edge is, and explain that you are the unique combination, and maybe even, you know, not companies that deal with you know, teeny boppers, with young people, but that aim at your demographic, people in midlife. And so you make the case that your age is a plus, your Spanish speaking is a plus, your storytelling is a plus, your writing rigorously and persuasively is a plus, therefore you become a compelling candidate. And if you send out, you know, say, you certainly answer ads that are for those companies that are appropriate, but you also write to their director of marketing communications or director of communications and make that pitch and see if they'll at least hire you for a project. If they hire you for your project, now you've got, you're going to be creating a portfolio, which you can then use to find other jobs. How's that sound?
That sounds great. What about, you have any direction in terms of not volunteer work, but perhaps gaining internships? So I can get that resume building.
Well, that's what you do is when you write those inquiries, you say that of course your first choice is to get paid, but that you're open to an internship or volunteer work as a launch pad. So you keep the door open to all three.
And great, man. Thank you so much for your time. What about follow up? Can you recommend any publications? Do you have a book perhaps?
I've written 7 books, but I'd rather you get some free advice. On my blog, I've written some of my most recent writings. Either they're just exclusively on the blog or they're links to, I write for AOL, for US News, and for Psychology Today. And they're all, I've put labels on them. So if you go to my blog, which is martynemko.blogspot.com, and then click on in the label cloud there, just click on career advice, you'll get a ton and it's free.
Okay, thanks.
If you want a book, my latest book is How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School.
I'm sorry I missed that.
How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School.
Wonderful.
Okay. You take care.
Okay, thanks for shooting the arm. Take care, Marty.
My pleasure. Very good.
All the best.
Okay, I'll give out the phone number just one more time. If you or someone you love has got a work problem, I usually can help. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I go back to the phones, I was enjoying, and I like to think it was helpful, sharing that list of musings that I have been collecting over the last couple of months. And so I'll just throw out a few more of those. So many people, the single biggest problem, you know, facing my clients is, you know, usually it's, sometimes it's intelligence, but more often it's their diffuse. They don't stay focused. They do procrastinate. And sometimes, again, I'm not saying it's a magic pill, but again, something that often works is to literally picture the benefits of achieving your goal. Let's say you should be looking for a job, you're procrastinating. Picture yourself. Whatever's going to motivate you is the benefits. Is it that clients who simply like getting dressed up in business suits and going to a nice office? Picture that. Or maybe it's getting your spouse off your back because you're finally employed. Create a picture. Maybe it's making a difference in the world. You know, picture the benefit of achieving your goal and here's the punchline, the liabilities of not. Picture if you keep procrastinating, you don't get a job. Picture yourself homeless. Picture your spouse leaving you. Whatever. Picturing both, because we're visual people, picture the benefits of achieving your goal and the liabilities of not. Another one of my musings, we give way too much credibility to speeches. It was Churchill who said, judge not by what a person says, by what he does, or she, of course. We really do. People have learned a tremendous amount about marketing, schmoozing, communication. There's some extraordinarily polished public speakers, not just in the political arena, although that is absolutely true, but it's also in the business arena, in the nonprofit arena. Please don't, you know, for example, if you are somebody who's interviewing somebody for a job, you're a manager and you're hiring somebody, look much more at what they've done, their work samples, than how good they sound in an interview. How many people have been coached up the yin yang to sound great in an interview, and they do, they're completely prepared, and then they suck on the job. As they say, you know, sometimes, so with some of those people, their very best day is the day they're interviewed. After that, it's downhill after they're hired. So please, whether it's your coworker, your supervisee, or a prospective employee, or a romantic partner, or whatever, don't judge people by what they say. Judge them by what they do, or the other come, you know, do they walk the talk? Another one. We celebrate diversity of Muslims and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists, and the reality is that still most people, if not, they may not go to church, but this country is governed primarily by Christian foundational principles. And I'm not talking about Jesus Christ. I am talking about the core values that exist in the New Testament. And one of the most core of them is humility. Be humble. Be humble before the Lord. You must, in today's world, if you are working in a largely Christian environment, a corporation, a nonprofit, doesn't matter, even if you feel you're hot stuff, even if you think people are inferior, if you show off, if you brag, and I do that unintentionally, but I do that and people don't think I'm humble enough, you will fail. They will subvert you. They will think he's too willful. That's another New Testament word. She is a know-it-all. He is not a team player. He's not collaborative. Those are all code very often for a lack of humility. So and I'm talking to myself here as well as to you. Remember the foundational secular Christian, if that's a word, because it is. It has nothing to do with God. But it's a secular value that has been inculcated into American society because of its Christian roots, which is the humility thing. Be very careful about hubris and bragging. And I'm talking to myself again, as I said. Okay. I like this one. We often use the word friend for famous people too gratuitously, but my dear friend, Dick Bowles, Richard Nelson Bowles, the author of What College Parachute, he set a wonderful rule of sermon giving. You know, he was an ordained Episcopal minister for a Episcopal priest for 50 years before he resigned. And he said a rule of sermon giving, and it applies much more broadly, he says, no souls are saved after 18 minutes. No long speeches. If you're giving a talk, keep it short. 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And that's just probably as good a time as any for me to stop talking and go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, I'm Sky.
Hi, Sky.
Hi. I have limited education, and I'm disabled. Mm-hmm. Yet I stumbled into some unexpected success volunteering to promote parties, bands, and events at a nightclub.
Okay.
And I really loved making new people feel welcome. Uh-huh. I loved inspiring people to support artists and mm-hmm. participate in the community. Mm-hmm. And I thought I might have some potential in fundraising.
Okay. Wonderful.
I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, first I have this interesting thought. Being disabled and being in the entertainment industry, you know, entertainment is one of those things where disabilities can be skirted. One of my proudest accomplishments in my whole life is I had a client who has autism, and her only thing she was interested in was singing, but she was very inhibited, could not connect with an audience at all, and I worked with her, and now she's an amazing performer. By the way, she'll be performing at Wisteria Ways, which is a wonderful house concert place on November 1st. But in any case, my point is that there are disabled people. I think about Marilee Matlin or whatever. It's not quite right. Marilee, somebody who is deaf, who had her own Broadway show for years, a deaf person. So maybe because you are disabled, and I haven't asked you what your disability is, doesn't matter, and you've been involved in promoting, you know, events like rock shows or whatever, maybe you want to find an existing organization that does do something in the area of entertainment with the disabled. Maybe even if it's a music therapy organization, and see if you could try being a fundraiser there, but at least talk with them. Have a heart-to-heart chat, coffee with them, saying, I have this unusual combination of being disabled, and yet I feel like I've done a really good job in making people feel welcome at these parties and events and these concerts. Is there a role for me possibly in fundraising? And if you identify a few of those organizations, who knows? Maybe you can make some money doing that. What do you think about that, Sky?
It sounds like a great idea.
I'm really glad you called. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
We have just a few minutes left, and so I'm going to fill that with a few more of those musings that I have had that I was saving up for you. Okay. I'm looking through the ones that are really worth your time. Yes. We deify, and I've said this in a different context a number of times on the show before, we deify the notion of following your passion and doing what you love. Something I have not talked about before is that it seems to demean the millions of people who do work that's unlovable. I mean, whether you're a ditch digger or an accounts payable clerk, or you're a dishwasher, or you are a widget manager, as long as it's ethical, it actually is worthy of more respect. I mean, if you go to a party and somebody says, "Oh yeah, I'm an environmental planner at the city of San Francisco," wow, cool. But if I said to you that I'm an accountant who's in charge of auditing, of make sure that all the bills are paid right, I mean, then you're going to probably not even want to pay attention. You're going to glaze over. And so the musing that I had there is that we unintentionally demean what is in many ways more worthy, because, you know, it doesn't take, you know, to go into acting or to go in the environment or go into, you know, biotech or be a doctor, you know, there you're going to get a lot of praise. But it takes a lot of fortitude and valuing of being productive to say, I'm not in a cool career, but I'm still willing to work and show up every day at work and be an accountant and make sure that everybody's paid the right amount. Those people really deserve, in my mind, more respect rather than our performers or our politicians or our actors, our sports people. So that was that thought. Another thought I've had. I was talking about the woman with autism. I've also seen as a useful training wheels for people with autism. You know, they used to call it Asperger's. Now, the new DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual, speaks of Asperger's as what's called level 1 autism. So I have seen Facebook and Twitter be very useful, kind of, as I said, training wheels for developing social skills. So if you, and it doesn't have to be, I'm guessing, I'm not sure, again, there's no studies on this that I have, I'm aware of, but if you or someone you love has got social issues, we can call social anxiety or anything, Facebook and Twitter, first of all, you can create an anonymous handle. You know, if you're a 60-year-old white male, you make yourself a 20-year-old, I guess you can, maybe not, I don't know, 20-year-old black female or whatever. It's a safe place to explore and trying being social. And you can reflect because you're writing. You don't have to be perfect on the spot. It might be good training wheels. Okay. Let's see. Last thing I want to say, very brief one. June Gruber, she's assistant professor of psychology at Yale, she said something very interesting. She said, "We incorrectly assume that sadness is always bad and that happiness is always good. Sometimes sadness allows you to be reflective, decide what you need to do more, and that happiness can be silly rather than productive." So I think that's not a bad way to end the show. We incorrectly assume sadness is always bad, happiness is always good, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more workovers on callers, and my guest will be Dr. Judy Melnick. She's the author of, love the title, Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. That's a coroner, you know. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.